Good morning. Let me get outfitted here. I am delighted to be here with you today. I have never been to Waco, so this was a wonderful experience to me to see the Truett Seminary and Baylor University and to hear what you are thinking about today. Now, let's see. Is it possible to lower the front lights a little bit? I think we would. What I wanted to do today is, and I hope we will have some discussion, is to talk with you about what I think are what is the general thinking about death that is in our society, in Western society, and some of the sources of it. And I also want to present some newer thinking about it that I believe is consistent with family systems theory. And I'm going to talk about Murray Bowen and some of his thinking about the impact of a death in a family as a process in a family as well as an individual problem for the individual who died. Okay, I wanted to start out with the definition of death as a physical, the end of life. It is the end of the living. There are spiritual ideas about life after death, but for every one of us, in every one of our families, as well as the people you and I talk to, we have to face death. And that in that process of someone dying, of ending their life here on earth, there is mourning. And part of what we're going to talk about today is what that means, what the process of dealing with the death of an important individual means, and how you might think about it, how you might address it in your work. Now, this character, I'm sure you all have heard of, Sigmund Freud, can be thought of as somewhat old-fashioned. That is, he was the father of psychoanalysis. He had specific ideas that were his best interpretation at the time he lived as to what was going on in what he called the psyche, emotional life of the people he saw. Much of it in this day and age is not thought of as very scientific, but it also permeates our culture. So, for instance, every single one of you I know knows what a Freudian slip is. You know, it's like part of us. And there's a lot of other of Freud's ideas that permeates the way we think about things, even though we don't know it's from Freud. So Freud had, in 1917, he wrote this this article called Mourning and Melancholia. And what his idea at that time, and I will go all the way up to the American Psychiatric Association, who now agrees with him, but well, that's going to take me a few slides. He thought that mourning was related to depression. And that, you know, if you sort of think about this, that mourning would be a reaction to a concrete loss in one's life. Depression is something somewhat different in our current way of thinking. But he equated them because he thought they both were a mourning for something that was lost. That's how he thought about depression. So very early on in psychological thinking, mourning has been seen as a pathology. And this is his quote. "We find a place for what we lose, although we know that after such a loss, the acute stage of mourning will subside. we also know that we shall remain inconsolable and will never find a substitute. No matter what may fill the gap, even if it is to be filled completely, it nevertheless remains something else. And this idea that you can never recuperate from an important loss is an undercurrent in our society. And today I'm going to talk mostly about the people who have influenced Western thinking. I think in some other cultures, there are other ways of thinking about and conceptualizing death. And but I'm not, I don't think you run into those as much as what is currently in our Western thinking. So he said, well, what do you do about this inconsolable loss? And he proposed that the person needed to do grief work. And probably most of you have heard about that, haven't you? That you have to have grief work in order to overcome a death. And what he saw is that grief work reclaimed the psychological energy that is, it would be reclaiming the energy that had been put into the life of the one who died. So this was his view, that you had to reclaim the psychological energy in order to, quote unquote, heal. And this is done by engaging in a review of each single one of the memories and hopes that bound the libido, which is also the life energy, to the object, which is the death of a loved one. So let me just try to summarize this, is that Freud was thinking that you had to really enter the emotional state of mourning in an intensive way in order to do the work to get through it. That is a foundation of some types of grief work as it is practiced in this day and age. And I'm guessing that it's influenced some of the pastoral thinking about it. He says this is done little by little with and it's extraordinarily painful. So you sit and talk with the those who mourn about the life and the memories of the one they are mourning. Now a second influential... Okay, so Freud proposed the idea that there need to be grief work, okay? And that has been a very influential idea in the 20th century, the 21st century. This is John Bowlby. He is the father of attachment theory. And he proposed that there were stages of grief work, not just generalized grief work, but there were stages of grief work. And he came to the idea that these stages developed from his observations of children who were separated from their mothers when their mothers gave birth to other children in the family. And John Bowlby thought that there were stages these children went through. So when the mother, for instance, went to the hospital or was off on her own and the children were left, he proposed that they went through these stages of protest, anger, sadness, despair, withdrawal, and disorganization. John Bowlby, I don't know if you realize, is profoundly important in today's theories about children. It's called attachment theory, and much of, I don't know if you've heard of Dr. John Sears, but he is a proponent of attachment theory to young mothers today. And you will probably hear a lot about that in your work. So what Bowlby did is he modified these stages for grief. So he took stages he saw the child go through, and he said, this has to be similar when someone dies because it's a loss. And I know you all have heard of Kubler-Ross, who has probably is the most influential writer about grief, death and dying and grief in our modern psychological history. So Kubler-Ross and David Kessler took John Bowlby's ideas. You know, this I'm trying to sort of trace a trajectory for you from Freud, who stated there needed to be grief work, to Bowlby, who said there were stages of grief, to Kubler-Ross, that then identified five stages of grief. And you probably have heard these, heard a great deal of these. This is denial. You can read it. Anger. So you deny that this person is actually expect to see them in the doorway. You can't believe they're not calling on the phone when the phone is ringing. Then there's anger. Why did this happen to me? Bargaining. If I just did this, maybe you'll come back. Depression. And then acceptance. And to be fair, you know, Kubler-Ross says that you don't have to go through all these stages in exact order, but that you identify these stages of grief, and that in order to, I mean, I think the important thing that I want to sort of touch on is that in order to get over the loss, you need to go through these stages. And if you don't go through these stages, then you may be suppressing your grief or not adequately processing your grief. They have somewhat of the similar ideas as Freud about what how you address this with the individual or the family. It is focusing on recounting the loss, on feeling the emotions, and then their contribution has been to work through them in these particular stages. And once again, as with Freud, grief is thought of as a pathology similar to depression. And that, to me, is a very important idea to think about. You know, in what way is grief similar, and in what way is grief different than depression? So the important thing would be if the person does not process the death and work through the stages, they are, quote unquote, not in touch with their grief. Are any of you familiar with that idea? Yeah. So I'm just saying this is what we, it's like what we breathe. You know, we learn about sort of how these things are thought about. And that, so in case you were interested, this comes from John Bowlby through Kubler-Ross. And there are other theorists out there, but these are the predominant ideas that are in our culture. So then we get to the APA. And just recently this year, the APA is working on a new DSM. And, you know, it's the Diagnostic Manual for Psychiatric Illness. And there is a DSM-4, which we've used for years, and they're working on the DSM-5. And in that process, they decided that grief was a treatable illness. So this is how widespread the idea is that mourning is a pathology. And so anyone who has grief over 2 weeks can now be diagnosed as having depression rather than a normal grief reaction, which is the way it was proposed in DSM-4. So this is a very significant sort of theoretical frame for thinking about how we, because we all, I think, have experienced this. And I don't know how many of you, I know for myself, I'll talk a little bit more about that later, have gone through a period of extensive mourning for someone who was very important. And, you know, is the best way of handling that to get medication, which is what is now part of the psychiatric evaluation. So the idea would be that the brain chemistry, as in depression, is being regulated in a way that the person is acting as if they were depressed, and that if you could correct that brain chemistry, they would feel better. You know, and then we can have a discussion about what are ways that are useful of coping with grief. So this is the Lancet, and the Lancet is like the New England Journal of Medicine. It is the English, the most prestigious English medical journal, and they said they say that medicating grief so that treatment is legitimized routinely with antidepressants is not only dangerously simplistic but also flawed. Building a life without the loved person who died cannot be expected to be quick, easy, or straightforward. And I think that there are many religious traditions that recognize this. I know, you know, in the Jewish tradition, they sit Shiva, thank you, at a year, you know, or in many cultures, previously you wore a black armband for a year. Or you wore black for a year. That the idea was that it took a while to have a reorganization of one's life and one's emotions and one's thinking to cope with an important death. Okay, I wanted to talk about this man because he is sort of the foremost researcher on what is now termed as bereavement, the science of bereavement. And, you know, you have Freud, who had his theoretical ideas about mourning and melancholia. You have Bowlby, who took the ideas from children who were in separation from their, young children in separation from their parents, and translated those into ideas about mourning. And then you have a more scientific approach that John Bonanno has been in the forefront of. And what Bonanno did, he is a professor of psychology at Columbia University in New York City. And what he did is he didn't take a framework of thinking and say, this is the way it should be. He studied bereaved people. He studied thousands of people about what happens to you when someone dies that's important to you, that you loved. Well, how do you feel? What do you do? What is it that, how do people cope? And he then wrote this book called The Other Side of Sadness, which is very interesting if you want to take it out of the library or order it. And so what he did was introduce rigorous methods of scientific study. And he came up with the idea that's different than the predominant ideas that I've talked about, which is that there is a natural resilience around death. That is, there are people, you know, who are not in psychoanalysis or in counseling, where someone who is very important dies, and they're able to regroup and go on with their life. And it isn't that they didn't care about the person or love them or had an important connection to them, but they find other ways to go forward, to re-engage life. And that this is an important, this natural resilience of the human race is important to focus on, rather than the idea that if you don't show a lot of outward grief, that you are not dealing with grief or doing the grief work that needs to be done. And here are some of his ideas about resilience. And he also talks about trauma. Trauma was a big focus for Bowlby in attachment theory, that if you experience trauma growing up, you will, your adult life will have all kinds of problems. And Bonanno has a different viewpoint about this in his research. He says that natural resilience for most people is the main component of grief and loss reactions. And he doesn't say people don't react to death. He says they have a capacity to be resilient in the face of loss, which is different than saying mourning or is a treatable illness. So I'm trying to sort of show you this is a different way of thinking about this. And what he believes in his research, you know, of just interviewing people that have gotten through mourning and have sort of emerged on the other side. He has a lot of vignettes in his book of examples of what in the way he thought that happened. But he said, you know, it's not that it's actually harmful to people to talk about endlessly, you know, to do this grief work. It has the opposite effect, in that in talking about how sad you feel, that often triggers sadness, that often makes the reaction more powerful. And that this idea that you need to go through and have this emotional processing, that you need to do that in these stages, is not helpful to the individual. And so he pretty much has suggested that the Kubler-Ross model is not a useful way to go forward with grief counseling. Now, these are the attributes of resilient people. They are able to talk about the deceased. They have positive memories of the deceased. They're able to talk about that. They have the ability to adjust to life demands and to be optimistic about their future. They have flexibility in expressing sadness and grief. That is, they can say, I feel very sad today, but this afternoon I had a wonderful conversation with my sister, and I really enjoyed that. Or, you know, I went to talk to my grandmother, or I take delight in my grandchildren, or I have a project that I'm going to focus on that is important in my life. That is, they can be sad, but they can also manage to look for other meaning in their life. And you know, this last idea is that death opens new possibilities in life, which is very interesting. I mean, it's a very interesting way to think about it. That is, you know, particularly in a family, and I'll talk a little more about this later, that when someone important dies, it really can create a shift in a family where there is an opportunity for other people to step forward, you know, particularly in the next generation. But even in, you know, just this last week, I had a whole series of interviews with people whose mothers had died when they were, you know, teenagers, or they were young enough, varying ages, but before they were adults. And so I'm always interested, you know, who in your family stepped forward? And it's fascinating to see that who it is. I mean, sometimes it doesn't happen, and I think there is a fallout for the person. But often, the woman I'm thinking of, her mother died when she was 13, and her aunt moved in and took care of them, and the grandmother lived next door. And she said, "I had a great childhood. I had a great childhood. Those people were very important and were very sustaining for me." So it depends upon, you know, that there are opportunities in death as well as the loss. So this is how Bonanno thinks about the process of grief. That for what he calls normal people, and, you know, I don't know who normal people are, but I'll call them resilient. You know, you have the death, and people will feel very low, but they will find a point in their life that they enjoy. And then they will feel low, and then they will find another point. And that it's a process. Probably most of you are familiar with this, that, you know, an anniversary will trigger great sadness, or a memory of a day that you were with the deceased, or a color or a scent or a holiday or a food tradition that brings up those memories and makes one feel sad. But then there's something else that happens that is rewarding and uplifting. And so he sees this as just a process of making your way through it. And that he calls resilience. Now, I'm going to talk in a minute about Bowen theory, because I think that this is a point that Bowen makes. He says that some people do not get through grief in this way. And he says there are people who have difficulty in overcoming grief. And one of the reasons that I didn't show the video today was because I didn't really have enough time to do it. But I have, I'm doing this later this week, this presentation, and I interviewed two different women, one whose mother died and one whose husband died. And the one, especially the one whose husband died, has had a great deal of difficulty. It's, I think, been 2 years now in putting her life on track. And I would say that she fills this bill right here. That is, she says on the videotape, you know, my life was fulfilled through my husband. I didn't have a life really that I loved until I married. You know, marriage was everything to me. I don't know what to do when, now that I'm single. It makes me so distressed. And part of her, so that she virtually lost her identity when she lost her husband. And that isn't true of everybody. I mean, I think that some people can lose a very important person, but they still have some core that's directing them of what is important spiritually, but also, you know, in terms of their relationship system. This woman and her husband had a special bond with each other, but no children. During their marriage, her mother had died, to whom she was very close. And I think some of her work has been to find other relationships in her family, which is what I would call the opportunity she's had. People that she were part of her family, but that she never particularly related to outside of how she was relating with her husband. So that when somebody is overly dependent, you know, where they see the person who died as the one who gave them nurturance and support, and they have difficulty in functioning independently, that when that person dies, that is going to really undercut their ability to function. And often people can just stay sort of drowning in grief. So what Bonanno says is that when the ties are too intense, too dependent, and too wrapped up in the life of the one who died, that person's going to have a lot of difficulty. But he also says that's the exception. That's the exception. It's not everybody that goes through that. So there's a variation in grief response. And I think that is a very important part of Bonanno's contribution. You know, Freud and Bowlby are saying this is what people go through. You know, this is what you should go through. If you don't go through this, you're not doing it right. Bonanno is saying, you know, people are different. And that when you are very dependent on a person who dies, then you have more work to do to reestablish your life than someone who is, you know, has a foundation for their life and is connected to important people other than the deceased. Okay, so you're going to hear about this guy today, Murray Bowen. Dr. Creech introduced him. And Bowen's contribution, in my opinion, to thinking about human functioning is he said that all of us, this is not about pathology or about problems, he said that all of us are connected to important relationships in our family in a very interactive way. And even though you don't see your mother or some of the other family members very often, the impact of that original relationship system will extend into your adult life, into the relationships you recreate in your nuclear family, and so that it's a very, the original family is a very powerful influence. And I'm not going to give you a whole spiel on Bowen theory today, but the one I like to talk about is sibling position. One of his ideas is about sibling position. And if you're interested in learning more about Bowen theory, you can ask Dr. Creech or Dr. Long, because it is about all of us. And one of Dr. Bowen's ideas was that it isn't about, you know, congregants or clients, that all of us, there are ideas about that are relevant to each of us about how we function in our family. So one of the interesting ones that I always like to talk about is sibling position. And in sibling position, I mean, what he's talking about is there are facts in your family that relate to your functioning. And the theory is based upon how all of those intersect. But in sibling position, he would say that the oldest is generally, like the oldest daughter in a family, generally is very comfortable in taking charge. They're often teachers, nurses. I mean, I guess these days it may be pastors. I don't know. Whereas the youngest tend to be more free, floating spirits. And with oldest brothers, they tend to be authoritative, take responsibility, you know, take charge. And, you know, one of my children has six children. And I just see those siblings as a petri dish, you know, are going like, there he goes, he's the oldest. Yeah, he's a, and the oldest one is like the oldest in living color. But anyway, Bowen said that the human and the human family could be understood. You know, he said that he started out as a psychoanalyst, but he said, I don't think that, like the Oedipal complex, I don't think it's all about sex. I don't think that some of the ideas that Freud brought to the table really describe the human. And so he began to study the human family and developed his theories. So he says the family, the original family, is an emotional unit, and that the people who are a part of that unit are very important in how, in the interactions, in how each of them functions. And the emotional unit can be the nuclear family, but it could also be the nuclear family and the grandmother. It depends upon the relationship system in terms of who is important. It could be the aunt and the grandmother in the family I was describing where the mother died. It is that sort of that basis of how each of us learn the meaning of what a relationship is. You know, every family is a little bit different. So how you think about a relationship may be different than your husband or wives, or even your sister or brothers. You know, that your position in your family has sort of an imprint on how you think relationships work. So, you know, if you're an oldest, you expect people to help you, and they will appreciate all of your good advice. So what he is saying, that the original family is an interactional unit in which there are reciprocal interactions. And that would be that the child, you know, a baby, when it's born, is pretty much in charge of the family. I mean, you may think of it as helpless, but it's really not very helpless. I know several of you are about to have babies. Well, just beware. You may think you're the adult, but the baby is pretty much organizing, you know, wah, 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 and the mother is like right there, you know. So that these are reciprocal interactions. And, you know, the idea is that the parents are in charge, but that the child is reacting to the parents and the parents are reacting to the child. And that over time, these have patterned responses that we all come to live out. And I don't have time to talk about all the pattern responses. So Bowen talked about differentiation, and Ms. Harrison is going to talk about this in her talk. But what I think he was touching on is exactly what Anna was talking about, that differentiation would talk about the ability of the individual to be connected in the family, but also to have some integrity of self. So that, for instance, if I'm extremely dependent and don't exactly know, you know, continue to live at home when I'm 35, I have not garnered enough self to launch myself and be an adult in the world. And that these the dependency that each of us have on our original relationships varies. You know, it's like the grief reaction. It varies. Some people are very connected to their family, but very capable of being out in the world and doing what they need to do. You know, having a job and profession and doing capable work and having their own family. But they also can recognize how important their relationships are. There are others who go out and either who don't go out or else deny the attachment and say, you know, my family stinks, so I'm not going to talk to him. I'm just me. And he would say those are two sides. The denial of attachment and the super attachment would be two sides of the way what is called fusion. Okay, so this is my meager attempt to do this with animation. So the idea would be this family is less, you know, has more flexibility. That is, they're connected, but they also have some capacity to be engaged out in the world. This family is more on top of each other. And, you know, you may say, I mean, I'm seeing a family like this right now, you know, why don't you let your 15-year-old son take charge of his homework? You know, so the mother says, well, he doesn't do his homework. So then we talk about the chicken and the egg, you know. If he doesn't do his homework and you remind him every 5 minutes, when is he going to ever take responsibility for doing his homework? But the fact he doesn't do his homework, you know, gets the mother engaged. And so they, I would put in this category over here. And, you know, a family where somebody gets a low grade, let's say a teenager, and the mother says, you know, if you don't pull up your grade in chemistry, I don't think you can go on that special trip or something like that. So then the child pulls up his grade, you know, where there's a little more maneuvering room to engage each other as individuals. Okay, so when stress hits, this family gets more fused, more dependent on each other. The dependent family gets more dependent. This family has more capacity to operate as individuals when a stressor hits. And I'm talking about death right now. I mean, there are many other stressors, unemployment, illness. Okay, so that what Bowen is talking about is that each of us have varying capacity in coming from our original family, which is what this is here. These are symbols for a marriage and a husband and a wife. That we have this imprint that comes from our original family, and that some people have more capacity to reflect, to choose, to think, to plan, and some people, we all have this balance, but some people are more driven by their emotional reactivity. Oh, sorry, wrong way. So I'll just sort of frame this just quickly so that each of us has a varying degree of capacity to think for self in the face of our emotions. You know, our emotions are there. Everybody has emotions. But the mother who is on that child all the time is, from my point of view, is sort of driven by anxiety. She can't see herself separately from the child. If that child doesn't do well, I'm not a good mother. You know, there is this interdependence where the child is having difficulty separating. In the other family, the mother is more capable of thinking about the child as a separate being for which she has a responsibility, but that her interactions are important, but the fact, the ideas are not so driven by emotion. So the togetherness is the reaction to the individual's, the sensitivity and reactivity to the thoughts and opinions of others. And that can be, especially with children, it can be, the reactivity can be, I'm not going to do what you tell me. Or it can be, I have to do everything you tell me. Versus, let me think about what you're telling me and see if I can work a way to do what I need to do and also take into consideration your thoughts, you know, of the parent. So there's a variation. I know that you probably have known families where they seem to just, it's like rolling down a peaceful river. The children do what they need to do. They go on with their lives. They have professions, they marry. And then there are other families that have multiple problems. You know, they're fragmented, they are reacting to each other, they have problems which create more problems. I mean, that was my life for many years with families with addiction. You know, that the addiction was a coping mechanism, and then the family reacted to that. And that just got everybody all the more upset. Bowen doesn't put a value on this. I mean, he doesn't say you're good and you're bad, you're pathological and you're normal. He just says there's a range. There's a range of how we function. And this is the human race. It isn't about a particular culture. You know, there are people who function well in India. There are people who don't function so well in India. In China, you know, that that some families have more capacities to maneuver than others. So from my point of view, Bonanno is a breath of fresh air because there is so much in his research that is parallel to Bowen's ideas. Now, Bonanno is a psychologist. He's not a family systems person, but he also has studied for years and years and years the concept of bereavement, and you know, has some actual statistics to go with that. So in the variability, so Bonanno is saying the same thing as Bowen, which is there's a variability in those who mourn in coping with the death. So Bonanno says that one of the important things is the degree of resilience in the family already. Bowen would say that differently, although I think they're trying to touch on the same thing. I mean, he's calling it the level of differentiation. You know, and the idea would be that there are some families that are going to go through this, or some individuals that are going to go through it, and they're going to regroup. And there's some families who aren't going to have as easy a time. What Bonanno says is that one of the variables is that the person who is mourning, and this is something that I always look for in a family, so I don't know if exactly where what your background is, but if you are pastors, if you're talking to a family, one of the questions to me would be, who do they have to talk to? Who is their, quote-unquote, support system? Bowen would call that having viable connections in the family. You know, and viable connections wouldn't be Aunt Ruth, who you haven't talked to for 12 years. It would be people who are important and engaged with you and who are meaningful. You know, I remember after a death in my family, I went to visit my cousin. And I just sat down and talked to her. And when I came home from that visit, I felt completely different. I felt completely different. And I can't tell you what that conversation, we talked a little bit about the person who died, but I can't tell you about what the conversation was about, other than I felt this was a very important connection who was alive, you know, who made me feel comfortable and that this person cared about me. So they both say having people to turn to is important. And this, I think, has to do with the resilience or the level of differentiation. So Bonanno calls it the ability to adapt to shifting demands. And that would be, you know, if you're unemployed, if you lose your job, you know, what's your capacity to be proactive and creative about getting a new job? Or do you sit there and feel depressed that you've lost your job? You know, that there's a, you know, people have concrete environmental conditions, and then there's the inner soul or a being that manages self. So Bowen calls it the thoughtful adaptation to life's challenges. And when he says thoughtful, he means non-reactive, like, I can't believe you fired me, you know, versus like, you know, it is what it is, let me see what I can do with this. And Bonanno talks about the flexibility in expressing sadness and grief. And I think this is comparable to Bowen's idea of the separation of thinking and feeling. That is, the feeling state does not determine one's life totally. You know, you can be sad and make a decision to go visit your aunt or something like that versus just lying around feeling terrible. So I thought, you know, in thinking about death, I thought that the thoroughness of Bonanno's research brought something to Bowen's original ideas about how, what is the flexibility in the grieving process, which I think takes it out into a whole different way of thinking about it. It's like, what are you going to do that will be of use to you to get through this versus, you know, you are depressed, you know, this is like, you know, this is, you need some treatment, you need some antidepressants, we need to make you feel like you're not depressed, versus what is it going to take for you to reestablish a life that's meaningful and productive. Okay, and so the final thing is that Bonanno talks about the intensity of the bond, and in Bowen theory, that's called fusion. Bowen created this word fusion because he thought it was descriptive of the interplay between two people, the intensity of the interplay between two people, the connection between two people. And the idea is we all need to be connected. The human is a social, we are social beings. The worst thing you can do is to put somebody in isolation or solitary confinement. That is the worst punishment you can give them. I mean, people do a lot worse in prison, in solitary confinement. Or if you have a problem in your life, the worst, one of the variables is if you are isolated and don't have anybody to talk to or that cares about you, you will do worse. Almost any symptom is like that. Anyway, that I know. So, okay, so those are two different theorists, Bonanno and Bowen, that I think have an important parallel. And I think that Bonanno is fairly influential. I don't, you know, I'm not an expert in grief work, but I think his thinking about bereavement as a science has had a very big impact on what we have traditionally known. Now, the other thing that Bowen talks about, in this is in the article that Dr. Creech was talking about, is the death as a family process and the family reaction to death. And this is where Bowen departs from Bonanno. Bonanno is not a He's not a family systems person, per se. So what Bowen is talking about is that grief is not an individual phenomenon. You know, as an individual, you may experience grief, but it is not simply a reaction to the death of the person who you cared about. It is also the reaction of the other people in the family to the death of the person, your reaction to them, their reaction to each other, so that I'll give you a family example that I'm well acquainted with of what happened in one family. But it would be that death creates a restructuring of the family emotional process. And it can work on many levels. I mean, the death of a child, which you may be familiar with, has an extraordinarily profound effect on particularly the nuclear family. And many families in which there's a death of a child don't make it. You know, there is, it's a very high divorce rate. So that the way the family was operating is profoundly altered by the death of a child. You get the death of a spouse, and probably that happens somewhere in your family, where then the other partner has to regroup and figure out a way to manage the family, either without the person who was providing the income, or in more traditional, back a couple of generations, usually the mother was, you know, the primary support for the children. So that then the family has to restructure itself. You know, when a step-parent is brought on board, I had part of my family is from Indiana, and they... in the early 1900s, there was a just widespread tuberculosis in that area of Indiana. So a lot of people died, and they were, you know, you'd have like a family where the mother and father had two children. The mother would die. The father would remarry. another child, the father would die. So then the stepmother has the three children, you know, and so that there's all of this. And yet some of those families, you know, we're talking about resilience. They did okay. You know, some of them didn't. But there's a variability and there's a structure, a restructuring of the family when someone dies. And part of what I think has been important to look at, well, I think Bowen would say this too, is that people have different importance in families. You know, Uncle Joe, who was single all his life and, you know, maybe visited the family on Christmas, has a different importance than a grandmother. You know, and it's the role of the grandmother. The grandmother's death may have a different significance for the family than the grandfather's death. It depends on the emotional importance of that individual to the family as to the way the family is going to react. Now, Bowen brought up this idea, which I have found to be very helpful and useful, although it's one of those ideas that you can't prove because you can only document it. You can't, I don't think, prove it. And what he said is that when someone who is important dies in a family, it can create a shock wave. And that in subsequent years, based upon the dependency of the family, there can be a series of symptoms that family members exhibit. And that this is sort of the emotional shockwave of the death. So you can say, what difference does it make to Johnny, who's in fifth grade, if his grandfather dies? And so then you look at what was the importance of the grandfather to the mother. You know, in what way did the mother then tune out? Johnny starts acting up and having problems. You know, the mother is not emotionally available at that moment. Or, I'll tell you about the family I know the best, about their what happened with them. So he says it operates on an underground network of emotional dependence of family members and each other. So this is a different way of thinking about grief. It's not about grief. If you ask Johnny, how do you feel about your grandfather dying? He might say, I miss him. This is talking about how the family structure is impacted and the emotional connections are impacted by a death over time. In the reshifting of the relationship system. So he says that, this goes back to the variability. The less flexibility of the individual, the less adaptive that individual and family system is to life events that have emotional significance. So that the family that has more of the fusion, more of the dependency on one another, would have more difficulty in dealing with death. And when their adaptiveness to life situations is succeeding, then symptoms develop. And that is, I think, when depression actually occurs. Okay, this is a basic idea in systems thinking, which is when a change happens in a family, it changes how each of them react to the others, and that's what I've been talking about. Okay, so I wanted to just briefly talk about the S family. The S family would be a pretty average family. The mother... Up here, I'm going to talk about the mother and the father are probably the best functioning of their siblings. The father was quite successful. They had three daughters. And this family, this one daughter married and divorced, but these other two had children, and they were all successful professionally. And this went on, so in 1990, this family was doing, you know, quite well. You know, there were no specific symptoms per se. So in 1997, and that had gone on for decades, that they were coming along. I don't have it here. The father died in 1994, but the mother dies, or the grandmother dies in 1997. And this woman was extremely important to her nuclear family, to this whole group. She was significant to these people. She was particularly significant to these people, a lot of contact, very respected. This sister had died before her, and she was very significant to this unit, this child and that daughter. And, you know, I think the family was very sad when this woman died. What I don't think they expected was the number of symptoms that cropped up in the next year. So this daughter became very reactive and cut off for the rest of her life from the family, never came back and spoke to them again. This marriage dissolved. This husband left. This child had a sort of a life-threatening drug addiction. This child ran away from home as a teenager. This boy went into a depression that was very concerning to them. And it's not to say that this family, I'm not saying this death caused these problems. I'm saying that the emotional waves that went down from the death of this significant person what Bowen said was a tipping point, and that it it just intensified what was already there. I mean, this woman was reactive, although she stayed in contact for her life until that death. And there are all kinds of efforts to re-engage her, but she was not to have it. And then, anyway, so that was in about a year's time, that was the outcome for that family. And I think that was a surprise. That was a surprise. And it was, you know, what did you miss? What was missed here in terms of this? Oh my goodness. One time. But I, you know, these are ideas that aren't the common, necessarily the commonly held out there. And so part of the hope was that you would have some discussion and questions and ideas of your own. Just to summarize, the reaction to death varies in families based on the level of differentiation of the family. I'm now talking about systems theory. And that includes the level of emotionality in the family. Bowen called it anxiety, the stressors on the family, and the position of the person who dies in that family. A shockwave can develop with symptoms over time. And you know what Bowen said is that people don't connect these things, you know, and that if you think about the death as a significant event in a family, not just for an individual, you have more of a capacity to see how the interconnections are affected. You know, if you just think, well, how do you feel about your mother dying? It's different than how do you see your relationship function over time with that death. And this particular family, I think, has reorganized very well. with the exception of the oldest sister who died sort of prematurely. You know, isolation is not good for people. So the family can reorganize. So I'll let you read this, but the idea is that, you know, the theories of Freud and Bowlby have been really pervasive in our culture and our understanding of grief. I think Bonanno has brought a new way of thinking about it, a new way of addressing it. I think with his ideas, they are very parallel to Bowen's, and Bowen brings the idea of a family system to the equation of the significance of that person and the reaction of the whole system to the death of that member. You know, that would create a reorganization. In some families, that goes very smoothly. People step up to take leadership. In other families, it has the death creates a vacuum in a way, excuse me, that then has that shockwave effect. So I hope I have stimulated your thinking today.